When you think of 1980s movies about robots and cyborgs, you probably think of Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Terminator movies. I do too, and I'm a big Arnold fan. He'll be Bach. But another film from the 80s that was perhaps in some sense even a bit more prescient, a bit more predictive of what's happened in the last few decades is a film called RoboCop. And that was a film, well, about a robotic cop and what he did and how he busted bad guys out on the streets and all sorts of interesting things. Well, guess what? RoboCop is almost here. And to tell you all about it is one of my colleagues and friends at the Duncan School of Law, Melanie Reed. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about RoboCop.
Don't change that station. It's time for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
The Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. And there's a very extensive body of case law that's developed over the last couple hundred years deciding exactly what unreasonable means in a whole variety of circumstances. But those cases apply to human cops. We're about to get non-human cops, at least in a supporting role and maybe in an independent role. Will the Fourth Amendment govern them in the same way, or will their enhanced or at least different capabilities fundamentally change this vital part of the Constitution? Well, that's the subject of a recent presentation, Law Review article by Melanie Reed, who's on the faculty at the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University, where I happen to teach and where I have recording equipment set up and where Melanie and I recently sat down.
I'm Melanie Reed. I'm a professor of law at Lincoln Memorial University, Duncan School of Law, and I teach criminal procedure and criminal law, federal criminal law, and comparative law.
That is quite a bunch of stuff.
I know.
And I'm guessing that before you came here, you had some relevant experience.
I did. I was an assistant United States attorney in Miami.
That's very impressive. Being an assistant U.S. attorney is impressive anywhere, but that's a big city, so that's a coveted position. Are you from Florida originally?
I am. Uh-huh. I'm originally from Tampa.
Right. So what brought you down to Miami?
Well, I was clerking for an 11th Circuit judge in Tampa.
That is also very impressive, Melanie. I'm starting to feel a little bit intimidated here. We've got getting federal clerkships is impressive enough. But circuit courtships, that's just one step below the Supreme Court. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I was very fortunate.
Who'd you clerk for?
Judge Charles Wilson.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. He's still there, still in Tampa.
Hello, Judge.
Yes. He's great. I learned a lot from him, and I was very fortunate to kind of segue that into working for the U.S. Attorney's Office. And then I moved on to Department of Justice and worked in their narcotics section in D.C. for a couple years before coming here to Knoxville, Tennessee.
In the narcotics section, did you get any samples?
No, I didn't get free samples.
Oh, okay. So you had some very interesting experiences down in Miami and in D.C. Going after the bad guys. And then what did you do after that?
After that, I decided I'd wanted to get into academia and teach law students about criminal procedure and how important it is to understand your rights and to be a zealous advocate for your client, as well as to be an ethical prosecutor. It's really important to me. And I've really enjoyed the transition and getting to work with, you know, law students.
How long have you been at LMU?
7 years.
7 years. You came here straight from DOJ.
Yes, I did.
Very, very nice. And the students here love you. I see you in your office all the time talking to them and teaching all those important classes that you teach. But beyond that, you do something else that law professors do, and that is you write interesting articles about important topics. And recently, you were kind enough to respond to my solicitation of all of our colleagues here at the Duncan School of Law, asking them if they had interest in constitutional stuff. And when I saw the heading on your email, I knew we would have to sit down because you sent me an email entitled, "The Fourth Amendment and Robots."
That's right.
Please.
The robots are coming. Let me tell you.
Is that what the message is?
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. They are. I mean, we're used to hearing about robotic pets, vacuum robots. I mean, I think my son is 2 and his favorite book is Robots, Robots Everywhere.
Right.
And so we're getting used to having robots in the home and in the office. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of time before we find that we have RoboCops. And if you look at the artificial intelligence technology out there now, IBM's Watson is one of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're using Watson to basically suck up all these medical encyclopedias and papers and then give you a diagnosis just by reading your face. I mean, they're predicting investment decisions. They're being able to look at your Twitter feeds and decide what kind of personality you have or what your opinions are. And so you take that artificial intelligence technology and you add the physical technology that's being used to try to create these 2-legged robots that can run, walk, skip, you know, be hit with 12-pound balls and still keep going. You're going to find RoboCops in the field with police officers sometime in the future. It's a possibility.
Not too distant future, it sounds like. And of course, that brings up a whole host of issues, constitutional issues. We like to say that the 4th, the 5th, and the 6th Amendments are the ones that are we typically sort of designate broadly as criminal procedure mm-hmm. subjects. In fact, you probably cover those all in your criminal procedure course, whereas the typical course I teach, the sort of general constitutional law course, sort of avoids them, not because they're unimportant, but because they're so important that we give them to somebody like you who has practiced in that area. Your particular foot, but the 5th and the 6th deal with a lot of courtroom stuff. Mm-hmm. The 4th is the one that really regulates cops in the field. That's the one that prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. So is that going to be your focus, the implications of this robot technology for the 4th Amendment?
Yes. I mean, the only other thing we cover is the 5th Amendment interrogations and things like that.
Right.
I don't know if we're at the point yet where we're going to find RoboCops doing the actual interrogations, but we definitely are going to see them out in the field using the tools that law enforcement are able to use that they can incorporate into a robot. So we have to kind of relook at what this whole concept is what is an unreasonable search? What is an unreasonable seizure? I mean, we already see that they use robots.
I think it's unreasonable when a robot stops me and searches me. I think we violate it the moment the robot's on the road, but I get ahead of myself. RoboCop is a term we've been using, but I understand from speaking to you briefly this morning that this robot technology didn't just magically appear in the 80s. It's been around a long time, and these things have been at least discussed in the popular literature for a long time.
Yes.
So you actually go all the way back to the 19th century and talk about this. In fact, we should mention that you did this in conjunction with a presentation. You did a presentation up in West Virginia, right?
Yes, West Virginia College of Law. The law review there had a wonderful symposium on future technology tools that law enforcement's using and its implication in the 4th Amendment.
Oh, okay.
And I was honored to get to speak there about these robots and the implications it has on the 4th. And what's really interesting is how we've evolved as to how we feel about robots, right? So as you were mentioning, yeah, I think one of the first discussions of robots was in 1868, the Steam Man of the Prairies. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at these robots.
The Steam Man of the prairies.
Yes.
Was this a book or?
No, I think it was a movie about a young boy who liked this steam man who was able to pull the carriage around, and he didn't have to. Robots don't eat.
Right.
You know, and he was superior to a horse.
Uh-huh.
And so he could go around and basically with this lack of physical needs, and he was immortal.
Right.
So they loved the Steam Man of the Prairies. And then we moved on to, you know, the Wizard of Oz, and we have the Tin Man and the friendly robot.
Tin Man was sort of a protective figure, wasn't he? Because he carried an axe.
That's right.
He was rusted in the middle of chopping wood when Dorothy found him. And after she oiled him, now he can wield this axe. And so at least he was sort of in the role of a protector while he was there. Okay.
Yes, yes. And then we have Robbie from the Forbidden Planet.
Robbie the robot.
And Lost in Space and C-3PO.
Danger,
and
Will Robinson. Danger, danger. Before we go past that, though, the 1950s. was not just Robbie the robot, and a lot of people have seen a picture of Robbie. He's actually pretty sinister looking. Mm-hmm. And I note also that he later came on as a nasty robot in Lost in Space. There was the good robot they simply called Robot, and then there was this, Robbie the robot sort of did a redux in Lost in Space. But the iconic robot, and the one that really fits what you're talking about from the 50s, was Gort, the robot from The Day the Earth Stood Still. And he was actually in the role of sort of an intergalactic or transgalactic enforcer of the galactic order. And he and Klaatu show up and stop all the machines on the Earth and give a warning to us. And Gort was pretty scary guy with that laser beam coming out of his face. Then you say the 50s, 60s, friendly robots.
That's right. They were friendly, and like they were servant robots.
Right.
So we looked at them as inferior to humans.
Uh-huh.
That we use them for our physical safe, for physical needs, for our safety,
right,
security, things like that. But we didn't think of them as equals.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, something happened in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of a sudden we have the Terminator. And now we fear that these robots are going to rise up and become, in a sense, superior to humans. They're going to try to assimilate into the human race.
That was a scary movie.
Take over. Yes, it was.
The Terminator was a scary movie.
And we lost some, we because we wanted this human, this security and convenience sake, we were willing to give up some to let these robots take over. And in the end with Terminator, well, we know what happened there.
All right, listen. The Terminator's an infiltration unit. Part man, part machine. Underneath, it's a hyperalloy combat chassis. Microprocessor controlled. Fully armored. Very tough. But outside, it's living human tissue. Flesh, skin, hair, blood, grown for the cyborgs.
Look, Reese, I don't know what you want.
Pay attention. I can ditch this car. The 600 series had rubber skin. We spotted them easy. But these are new. They look human. Sweat, bad breath, everything. Very hard to spot. I had to wait till he moved on you before I could zero him.
Look, I am not stupid, you know. They cannot make things like that yet.
Not yet. Not for about 40 years.
Are you saying it's from the future?
One possible future. From your point of view, I don't know tech stuff.
Then you're from the future too, is that right?
Right.
Right.
Cyborgs don't feel pain. I do. Don't do that again.
Just let me go.
Listen and understand. That Terminator is out there. It can't be bargained with. It can't be reasoned with. It doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear. And it absolutely will not stop. Ever. Until you are dead.
Was not a good ending. But, of course, I liked Terminator 2 and the role that Arnold played.
Yes.
In that particular one. He went back to being a protector in that one.
And I think that shows, like, how we as human beings, we have this kind of this feeling like they're good robots and they're bad robots. We have this tension on how we feel about them. But I mean, eventually when you start looking into, you know, how robots are portrayed now with like the movie Ex Machina and the TV show.
That was a good
show,
movie too, yeah.
Yeah. The TV show, HBO's Westworld. We start to see that robots no longer just want to assimilate. They want to be like humans. They want to have this human consciousness. They want this self-awareness. They want everything that humans have. And they, you know, basically ditch their creators and want to create this new race and this new society. And I think that as technology advances, so are we humans find that we're conflicted about how we feel about robots.
Yeah, this is a fascinating area. One of my favorite authors as a child was Isaac Asimov, a science fiction writer. And he, along with especially Arthur C. Clarke, were noted as being so-called hard science fiction writers. That is that they wrote fiction that was based upon, as best they knew it, real science and what might really be possible.
And Asimov's particular interest was robots, and he actually came up with the three laws of robotics, and it was sort of a legalistic construct that was actually very well thought out. But what it basically boiled down to was that robots were servants and that they could never harm humans. Mm-hmm. Robots are servants. They've got to obey humans, except to the extent that a human orders a robot to harm another human. I mean, it was a fairly well-integrated three laws of robotics there. But again, all of it designed to control this emerging artificial intelligence. But there's always been that fear. What happens if you don't have some sort of built-in inhibitor on this consciousness? Are we creating a new race of beings that will have consciousness, whatever that is,
yes,
which we're still debating, or at the very least will be so close to consciousness that it doesn't really matter? I think Alan Turing, the mathematician, came up with a test called the Turing test that was featured in that film you mentioned, Ex Machina. If you sit in a room with a robot and you can't tell whether this robot is a person or not,
mm-hmm,
then effectively you've created another being. I mean,
yes,
you could be a robot right now.
Yes.
Or I could be a robot. And if the other person, the real person, couldn't tell, then what's the difference?
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, my guest is Melanie Reed, one of my colleagues at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. Melanie's quite an impressive lady. Indeed, she recently received a Fulbright scholarship, and she'll be heading off to Europe next semester. In the meantime, she's speaking to us about robots. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Melanie Reed. Stick around. It's that happy, happy time of the week again. It's time for our constitutional quiz. And for a change, Doug Smith is looking happy today.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
It's so nice to see you, Doug.
Thanks so much.
And we have, I think we've got someone on the line, too. It sounds maybe like a dog on the line. Or somebody who's left. Who's on the line?
Marlene.
Marlene. And do you have a dog with you, Marlene?
I have two.
You have?
They're trying to play.
They're trying to play. Okay, well, are you ready to take a quiz, or do you need to go and take care of the dogs?
Oh, no, I'm ready.
Okay, Doug, do you have a quiz? Do you have a canine-themed quiz?
Actually, I don't have a canine-themed quiz for you, Marlene. I just have a good old-fashioned quiz, but I hope that you'll excel at it one way or the other.
I'm sure she will.
Are you ready? I'm going to read you the question. I'm going to give you four choices.
Yep, I'm ready.
All right, when you hit the choice you like, just bark.
Okay.
What part of the government does the Constitution provide the power to go to war?
Okay, so what part of the government gets to declare war?
What part of the government does the Constitution provide the power to go to war? Is it A, the executive branch, B, the legislative branch, C, the judicial branch, or D, the olive branch?
The olive branch?
Is that your final answer?
No, B.
What was B?
The legislative.
You went straight to that. You don't want to talk about the exec. Doesn't it, the president's got all the guns?
No, he does not.
Well, sure.
He has to clear it away with Congress.
Well, what about the judiciary? Are judges or judicial? Shouldn't they be in charge of declaring war?
No, absolutely not.
So, and the olive branch, you obviously don't want to grasp. See what I did there? See,
I saw that.
She doesn't want to grasp the olive. So
great.
You're going to insist it's got to be Congress that declares war. Is that it?
Gotta be B.
I can't dissuade her, Doug.
That's because she's right.
Absolutely. Marlene, well done. You are exactly right. Congress is the branch entrusted with the power to declare war. Of course, the president becomes commander-in-chief of the armed services once there is a war. And unfortunately, in the 20th century especially, there have been so many wars, including the current so-called war on terror, that Sometimes the president is seen as having some sort of unilateral authority to engage in military efforts, as we're seeing right now in Syria.
Well, no one appreciates that authority or power that's been grasped as much as the president. And I don't think it's the current president that does that only. I think we've seen that for the last few presidents, really going above and beyond without congressional authority to take military action.
Right.
I know that's been a perennial debate in the U.S. Senate and certainly far from being resolved.
It certainly is. Well, Marlene, you got it right. And so thank you very much. And I'm going to let you go because your dogs are obviously very excited by this. But send us a message on Facebook and give us your snail mail address. We'll send you your T-shirt and your pocket constitution, okay?
Okay, I will.
Thanks, Marlene, for playing. We appreciate it. We appreciate your questions, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. This week, my guest is a buddy of mine. Her name's Melanie Reed, and she sits right down the hall from me at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. Melanie is a very impressive person. She is a former appellate, a federal appellate clerk, which is a very, very impressive job for somebody to get right out of law school. She then worked for the Department of Justice, putting bad guys behind bars, and now she's writing law review articles about the future of policing under the Fourth Amendment. When the robots start to show up. Just before the break, Melanie and I were discussing the fact that these questions have been around for a long time.
One of my favorite authors as a child was Isaac Asimov, a science fiction writer, and he, along with especially Arthur C. Clarke, were noted as being so-called hard science fiction writers. That is that they wrote fiction that was based upon, as best they knew it, real science and what might really be possible. And Asimov's particular interest was robots, and he actually came up with the three laws of robotics, and it was sort of a legalistic construct that was actually very well thought out. But what it basically boiled down to was that robots were servants and that they could never harm humans. Mm-hmm. Robots are servants. They've got to obey humans, except to the extent that a human orders a robot to harm another human. I mean, it was a fairly well-integrated three laws of robotics there. But again, all of it designed to control this emerging artificial intelligence. But there's always been that fear. What happens if you don't have some sort of built-in inhibitor on this consciousness? Are we creating a new race of beings that will have consciousness, whatever that is,
yes,
which we're still debating, or at the very least will be so close to consciousness that it doesn't really matter? I think Alan Turing, the mathematician, came up with a test called the Turing test that was featured in that film you mentioned, Ex Machina. If you sit in a room with a robot and you can't tell whether this robot is a person or not,
mm-hmm,
then effectively you've created another being. I mean,
yes,
you could be a robot right now.
Yes.
Or I could be a robot. And if the other person, the real person, couldn't tell, then what's the difference whether that robot is thinking or is effectively just simulating thought?
And the problem is with artificial intelligence is they learn through experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the kind of the saying garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
I mean, Microsoft had a robot online, Ty, and they had to shut it down because people kept sending in, you know, on Twitter,
I remember this,
all those racist comments.
Yes, yes.
And so Ty was saying all these racist comments and, you know, things about Hitler and things like that, about how great he was because of all these things that he was learning, or it was learning from, you know, people that were sending in all these racist comments. So it's,
and obviously,
concerning.
I'm not laughing at the racist comments. Please don't misunderstand me. But when I saw that, when I saw some of this stuff that was coming out of this robot Twitter's mouth,
yes,
I was reminded of a little child whose people use swear words around, and all of a sudden the little kid starts spewing swear
That's
words.
Right.
You got to stop that. You got to stop it very quickly, even though you might be laughing inwardly when the kid comes out with some comment.
And that's
you've got a 2-year-old. That's going to happen,
yeah,
to you. But has it already happened to you?
Yes. And that's a concern because these robots, I mean,
they're learning babies.
Yes. I mean, they have a lack of empathy and they don't know these human judgment calls.
Right.
You get a RoboCop out there. How is he going to handle a tense situation, a domestic violence call? Is he going to be able to de-escalate the situation? Is he going to have enough experience to be able to understand what needs to be said, you know, in those tense situations? I don't know if we know that.
Right. Well, you remember the iconic scene from the movie RoboCop, where there are all these people at the robot corporation are sitting around in their boardroom, and they bring in RoboCop to demonstrate his ability to disarm somebody. Mm-hmm. And so one of the corporate executives is told, go pick up a gun and hold it up in front of the cop. And he does. And the cop responds, put down your weapon.
Dr. McNamara,
we'll need an arrest subject.
Mr. Kinney.
Yes, sir.
Would you come up and give us a hand, please?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kinney is going to help us simulate a typical arrest and disarming procedure. Mr. Kinney, use your gun in a threatening manner. Pointed at Ed 209.
Yes, sir.
Please put down your weapon. You have 20 seconds to comply.
I think you'd better do what he says, Mr. Kinney.
You now have 15 seconds to comply. You are in direct
And then, of course, the executive puts down his weapon, but then RoboCop's programming goes haywire. Mm-hmm. And he just blasts this executive through the window, I think, basically. And that's exactly what you're talking about, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Exactly. It's there's such a, we just don't know what's, and the scary thing is there've been a lot of studies done on the anthropomorphism of these robots, meaning, you know, these robots that look like they're human. And if you look at previous things that have been done to make robots look like, for example, the Google car, the bumper looks like a little bit like a grin. The nose, the sensor
yes,
in the
does.
Front looks like a nose. The headlights, the eyes, he looks kind of like he's smiling at you a little bit. I mean, even the first Apple computer, the personal computer, Steve Jobs was trying to make it look like there was like a little mouth. And
right.
I mean, they try to make that because studies show that if it looks human, we automatically take it in and accept it for what it is as a human, like a human being. But it's very difficult to predict how they're going to react in the field. And there was a study about this little robot, RoboV, in which they had human subjects interact with RoboV. And RoboV actually causes the subject to lose a $15 little game. And they excused RoboV's, the robot's actions more, forgave him more, and held him less morally accountable than they would a human person, but held him more accountable than if it was a vending machine that had made the mistake. Showing that we kind of allow these robots, if they look more human, to make a few more mistakes than they would even forgive a human being. It's kind
you
of
know, that can happen even with things that are clearly not human. Here's a shout out to my friend Jen at the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. She and I and another fellow, Mark Trickett, were working on actually a Fourth Amendment, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment online course mm-hmm. for Montpelier. And while we were doing that, we came across a news article about an Arctic boat. So this is anything but a robot. It's a big boat that's going to explore the Arctic. Mm-hmm. But it had a big curved line on the side of it that made it look like it was smiling and friendly. And they were holding an online contest for naming it in Britain. And the leading, in fact, the winning entry was Boaty McBoatface, which the powers that be rejected. But think about that. You're calling a boat something that's obviously designed to be cute.
Yes.
So we can anthropomorphize just about anything. And when you get something that actually has a human form or a quasi-human form, and it has these design features on it, that's going to have implications perhaps for how courts or how the public judges them. I mean, are we going to, I think what you're driving at is, are we going to have a different standard of what's reasonable depending on whether it's RoboCop or, you know, Steve the cop?
Well, and I think we need to understand that these robots are going to be faster, smarter, and much more efficient than human police officers.
Right.
And if that's the case, doesn't that change the whole scale of when you're looking at trying to balance an officer's actions and what he can do versus our civil liberties and trying to create that balancing act of what is reasonable, what can and can't they do? It's going to completely change it because, for example, let's say there's a tipster who says that there is a marijuana grow next door. Mm-hmm. Well, you get, you know, Officer Roboto over there with his human officer, and Officer Roboto can instantly subpoena, you know, utility company records and find out if there's an excess of electricity there.
Okay, now I'm following you. Today, if it's Officer Jane on the beat, she faces certain limitations.
Exactly.
And that goes into our calculus of what's reasonable for a given police officer to do. Well, we'd say Officer Jane didn't have time to get a warrant, or Officer Jane couldn't get the necessary records to determine whether there was probable cause on that visit, so she had to come back later. But Robbie the robot...
That's right.
He can get all that stuff.
He can get right there instantaneously, stand there. And so then once he gets that, he can immediately, based on the tip and the records, go ahead and send over a request for a court order to get a thermal imaging scan done of the house.
And he can do it himself.
Yes. Immediately
himself. This even impacts what we call, what's the concept? A plain view.
Yes.
I mean, what's plain view for you or me, if we're cops standing on someone's front porch, is one thing. But Robbie's got the thermal imager right there.
So he immediately gets the court order, can do a thermal imaging scan of the house, find the area in which there's excessive heat. Based upon now the tip, the electric records, and the thermal imaging, can then send another affidavit requesting a search warrant for the house. Let's say they also want to get a poll cam up to identify who the people are, go ahead, ask for a court order for the poll cam so they can start watching people. And then he can use his license plate reader to identify all the cars that stop in front of the house that perhaps want to go in and purchase the marijuana. He can also use his facial recognition scanner to identify the particular people. And then once they're ready to execute the search, Officer Roboto can go in. They start running away. Not a problem, because Officer Roboto can then turn on the GPS on the cell phone to track that particular person. And then before the human officer goes ahead and does the pat down at the arrest, Officer Roboto can use his terahertz scanner to scan him to see if there's any weapons before the human officer then goes ahead and goes through his pockets.
Yeah, I don't even know if the whole concept of a pat down is obsolete. Because right now we have human beings. We have eyes. We can't see in pockets. We might see a bulge in someone's pocket. That's the rationale for a pat down. I see a bulge in your pocket. Okay, I have a limited ability to search you based on a reasonable suspicion that maybe, you know, there's something wrong here. And I pat down, and specifically I'm there. It's basically a safety check. I want to see if that's a gun or a knife or something else. Robbie the robot can just, or Officer Roboto, as you're calling him, can just look right into the pocket.
And I think that what we fail to realize is that actually forcing an officer to go back to their office, to write the affidavit, to request the search warrant, to then walk over to the magistrate's judge's office, to go through having them review it prior to getting a search warrant or prior to getting a court order is a big deal.
Right.
And so we're completely eliminating that by having Officer Roboto immediately do these things, so it really makes us rethink what we think is reasonable and not reasonable.
Right. And I'll take a slight divergence here. And for all the police officers who are listening, and I know a number of them listen to the show, sorry, guys, it looks like your jobs are also at risk, just like all the drivers of trucks out there who are going to be put out of work by self-driving cars, and just like all the lawyers who are already being put out of work by advanced legal research and other techniques, and all the doctors who are going to be put out of work by diagnostic computers. That's a whole nother issue out there.
Yes.
But what we're focusing on is that, you know what this is like? It's like a group of people who are working on an assembly line with certain expectations of how quickly they can work on the line and what their quota is of getting things done. And then the new worker comes in who is, for whatever reason, just much more efficient and much better, raises expectations for everybody. That's why the old workers hate the new worker.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming in and messing everything up. Officer Roboto is going to raise the bar so high that it's going to affect our constitutional analysis. Maybe it'll be impossible for a human officer to meet the new definition of what's reasonable under the First Amendment, excuse me, Fourth Amendment.
I agree with you. We don't have any solutions, but we need at this point, but we need to start talking about this. We need to identify the issues. And I think it's very important because the robotic engineers are not aware of these legal ramifications. We have no dialogue. We need the legal field to communicate with these engineers, with these designers, to kind of talk about these things. And we need to start figuring out, when are we comfortable with autonomous robots? And when should we think about human-controlled robots? Because when we're talking about Fourth Amendment implications, I mean, that's significant. And we want to see what we're comfortable with. And I know at Florida International University, they have this discovery lab, and they created this robot that was able to pull cars over for speeding and things like that. But they have an officer that is equipped with sensors and is actually the voice of the robot that is actually doing the interactions at another location. And they just have the robot actually interacting with the person that was pulled over. I mean, so we have to start thinking, what are we comfortable with and what is acceptable? And we need to start communicating with those robotic engineers to try to figure out what we're going to do.
One other practical thing that comes immediately to mind is that the Fourth Amendment applies the same way across the entire nation. Mm-hmm. But if New York City or Los Angeles can afford Robbie the Robot and he's raising the bar, what about, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, which is a much smaller place with a much smaller budget? Do we effectively force everybody to use robotic officers because everybody has to comply with the Fourth Amendment? Does every little town have to have its own robot police officer in order to have that compliance?
I mean, I think certainly we're going to see the departments that have the money are going to be on the forefront of using these kinds of technology.
Right.
But that was what was so unique with the drones. Right,
because that's another thing that really frightens me. You were talking about having Officer Roboto with a pole camera, right? I'm thinking of Officer Flying Roboto flying outside your bedroom window with cameras poised and looking in at you. That's even more frightening to think of somebody who can fly around.
Mm-hmm. Well, and an autonomous person. An autonomous robot flying around.
That's what I was saying, because now, of course, we've got drones and we've got police drones and they're already flying around our houses.
And I mean, there've been reports. I mean, there's military drones now that they're training that can be autonomous and go out on missions and things like that without any human control. So that's another issue. We've got to create some sort of guidelines because we've never seen anything like this.
No, we certainly haven't. Well, do you have any suggestions about that? I mean, we've identified some problems here. What do we have to do? I mean, do we have a federal statute or do we simply wait for the cases to inevitably come up and gird our loins and get ready to argue things out in the courts? I mean, because if we simply leave this for the courts to resolve, then we're going to find ourselves playing catch up for the next, well, forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be proactive. I think we do need to start creating guidelines so that we can let these designers make them aware of what the ramifications are.
Maybe your friends at DOJ need to have a new office of robotics.
There you go.
And they need to establish these liaisons, and they need to come up with, I mean, DOJ does that. It comes up with guidelines all the time. So they're not law, but certainly they can guide federal prosecutors and federal agencies, that might be a good place to start. Maybe you'll have to segue back to DOJ for a while and run their Office of Robotics.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think drawing lines of when robots can be autonomous and when they're human controlled would be very, very important. And I think we need to be aware that we shouldn't be fooled by the cute robot. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be aware that we don't know what kind of biases robots are going to have.
So, Melanie, you're saying don't trust Bodie McBoatface.
God, I sound terrible saying that.
I'm afraid you're right. Well, any other thoughts, Melanie, before we finish up?
I don't think so. I'm good. That's great.
Thanks very much for sharing this with us today. And is your presentation going to be put into a symposium article?
A symposium article with the West Virginia University College of Law. So that symposium edition is going to be coming out pretty soon.
So sometime in the near future, if you're interested, you can find Melanie Reed's article in the West Virginia Law Review all about this. What's the title of your article?
It is Rethinking the Fourth Amendment in the Age of Supercomputers, Artificial Intelligence, and Robots.
Well, Melanie Reed of the Duncan School of Law, thank you very much for talking to us about this rather terrifying topic.
Thank you.
One last thing about Melanie before we go. She's just been awarded a Fulbright scholarship. She's going to be teaching in the Baltic country of Latvia starting this coming spring. That is quite a distinction. Congratulations, and thank you again to Professor Melanie Reed. This is as good a time as any to remind you that we're pretty high-tech around here, too. So please visit us online. We have a Facebook page. We have Twitter. And, of course, we have podcasts, hundreds of them, literally hundreds of them, up online about all sorts of constitutional topics. So please Google Your Weekly Constitutional. And one of the first things that'll come up is our podcast site. If you like us and start downloading, that'll just make us so happy. After the break, we're going to have a stat quote from Library Ann, also about technology and the law. So stick around. And now it's time to hear from Library Ann, who's going to tell us more about law and technology.
Machine learning and artificial intelligence, two topics that have been in the news a lot lately, and too much information to cover in just one stat quote. Instead, I'm going to read from several authors today and give you several stat quotes as we explore today's topic. Let's begin with a book written by Etham Alpaydan, a professor in the Department of Computer Engineering at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul. He is the author of a widely used textbook on the subject, Introduction to Machine Learning. The book I'll be reading from today is entitled Machine Learning, published by MIT Press in 2016 and available through our My iLibrary ebook subscription. The book begins by pointing out how our lives have changed dramatically in a relatively short period of time. Alpaydan says, some of the biggest transformations in our lives in the last half century are due to computing and digital technology. The tools, devices, and services we had invented and developed in the centuries before have been increasingly replaced by their computerized e-versions, and we, in turn, have been continuously adapting to this new digital environment. He goes on to say, the power of the computer lies in the fact that every piece of information can be represented digitally, that is, as a sequence of bits, and every type of information processing can be written down as computer instructions that manipulate such data representations. Let's pause for a moment and think about barcodes, where information is represented in terms of lines of different widths, which are shapes that are easily recognized by a computer. Think also about the printed text in a book. Many books use only one font that is easily recognizable. With barcodes or a book published in a single font, a single template exists to match the characters with the template and no machine learning is required. However, more complex data, more than one font or handwriting, may have more than one character match. For example, my cursive capital letter Q looks very different than my mother's cursive capital letter Q. My mother's Q looks more like the number 2 to me than the contemporary fonts used today. Having different characters with the same value requires the use of more than one template for comparison, and requires a sort of learning or matching. Characters may also be large or small, slanted, written with a pencil, or have other various attributes that would make matching each character difficult. In machine learning, the aim is to fit a model to the data. When the data is not easily matched, mistakes in the output occur, and despite all the research, there is still no computer program today that is as accurate as humans for remedying these errors. CAPTCHAs are used to distinguish corrupted images or words and intended to distinguish between human and machine input. If you've ever been asked to identify all the scenes with storefronts from a random set of images, you've passed a test that the majority of today's computers cannot. Just over the past 10 years, most of us have moved from having most of our personal data stored at home on a personal computer to having all the data stored in the cloud at some remote data center, but accessible from a wearable smart device. Alpaden says, with smart devices, there is no longer any need for millions of people to keep separate copies of the same song or movie or book locally all the time. In addition, our wearable devices collect all sorts of information about us, such as our heart rate, the number of steps we walk each day, and if your GPS is turned on, where you take those steps. Not to mention all the data in the form of questions you enter into Google. With all these data points, patterns develop, giving us more data to analyze and more data to share. Machine learning helps make sense of our increasingly complex world in ways that the human brain can't process. This is an important takeaway. Computers can process information much, 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 much faster than humans. However, as computers process information, the end result is not reached in a logical reasoning sort of way. Instead, computers are able to process vast amounts of information, and if there is enough data points from which to compare, it may appear that the computer is learning. The goal of artificial intelligence is to have enough data available and the ability to process this information at a speed high enough that the computer can predict what to do next. But it's not exactly learning. An example of machine learning in action is Watson. In another book published by ProQuest in 2013, Smart Machines, IBM's Watson and the Era of Cognitive Computing, by John E. Kelly and Steve Hamm, the authors recall Watson's debut on the game show Jeopardy. In 2009, Watson was still under development. One question asked, what does the AL stand for in the company name Alcoa? Watson answered, what is Al Capone? The computer had confused the first two letters of the chemical element aluminum with the first name of the famous gangster. Clearly, more work needed to be done. The authors say, one of the main purposes of these training sessions was for Watson to make mistakes so that the scientists on the technological development team could tweak the algorithms used by the computer and prevent the same mistake from happening again. However, the scientists soon realized that they could not anticipate every dilemma Watson would encounter, so they needed to invent a system that would enable Watson to learn on its own. The authors explain artificial intelligence as a system that learns from data. The field was first defined in 1959 by Arthur Samuels and builds systems that are trained to recognize repeated patterns in words or shapes and to react in a certain way when they encounter them again. The authors go on to say that in creating the technology for Watson, called Deep QA, which includes the learning capability, the developers provided the machine with a large corpus of unstructured information and the algorithms to extract knowledge from it. They trained the machine to identify categories of information, such as famous people, locations, and relationships, and also to parse language. Then they created a set of statistical methods for learning how words are used in different contexts. This combination of techniques allows Watson to learn from the data rather than just follow detailed instructions. In a sense, Watson learns the way people learn, by experiencing a lot of things and drawing inferences and lessons from those encounters. On the one hand, the goal of artificial intelligence sounds great. On the other, it sounds a bit sci-fi movie scary. Our next stat quote comes from a book written by Vincent C. Miller entitled Risks of Artificial Intelligence, published in 2016 by CRC Press and available through our MyEye Library ebook subscription. Miller begins by stating, if the intelligence of artificial systems were to surpass that of humans, humanity would face significant risks. In other words, it sounds like he agrees with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking, who warn that the growing power of artificial intelligence to imbue robots with the ability to both replicate themselves and increase the rate at which they get smarter will lead to a tipping point or technological singularity, when AI can outsmart humans. Miller goes on to explain that the notion of singularity is based on the ideology that all aspects of human mentality will eventually be substantiated by an AI program running on a suitable computer, so-called strong AI. At this point, when singularity occurs, humanity will have effectively been superseded on the evolutionary ladder and will be obliged to eke out our autumn days listening to Pink Floyd and gardening. Or, in some of Hollywood's more dystopian visions, cruelly subjugated or exterminated by Terminator machines. Miller goes on to proclaim that he doesn't endorse these concerns, but for very different and mundane reasons. First, Miller outlines how AI has historically failed and will continue to fail to deliver on its grand challenge of replicating human mentality in all its raw and electrochemical glory. He begins by explaining that computers lack phenomenal consciousness and explains this in scientific terms I do not understand and cannot relate on to you. Lucky for me, he goes on to explain his next point in a more straightforward manner. Computers lack genuine understanding. Miller recants the results of a 2012 deep learning project where Google deployed computers to categorize more than 10 million unlabeled images found on YouTube videos. So what did the Google brain do? Exactly what you'd expect. Google looked for cats. Google's deep learning network classified images with descriptions, like faces, cats, human bodies, which would suggest that Google was learning, although it wasn't. It was just good at identifying similar images. Google can't actually understand what a cat is, but it could identify an image of a cat and label it as such. If AI was limited to labeling images, I'm sure only the digital archivist among us would be concerned. However, AI has also been used to help protect human life in both police and military exercises, such as using robots to disarm bombs or create autonomous weapons to protect against perceived threats. It's the military's use of AI that concerns Miller the most. He says, systems that can make decisions to militarily engage without human intervention may rapidly escalate situations to catastrophic conclusions or demonstrate artificial stupidity. Miller lists the three core obligations of the international humanitarian law. Number one, to identify combatants from non-combatants. Number two, to make nuanced decisions regarding proportionate responses to complex military situations. And number three, to arbitrate on military or moral necessity regarding when to apply force. If you think back on the terrorist actions over the past 3 years, I think we can all agree how difficult it would be to determine who is a combatant and who is a non-combatant. Figuring this out usually requires the determination of intent, or attribution of intent. Humans understand emotion and the display of emotion where computers cannot. Miller gives an example of a frightened mother running after her two children, yelling at them to stop playing with toy guns. A human soldier could identify the mother's fear and the children's game and recognize their intentions as harmless. However, a fully autonomous weapon might see only a person running toward two fully armed individuals. The former would hold fire, and the latter might launch an attack. Intent, or the attribution of intent, is often the basis of determining whether an individual is guilty of a crime or not. Another well-known figure has added his voice to the chorus of concerned citizens, Warren Buffett. During a six-hour Q&A session during the recent Berkshire Hathaway's annual meeting, one of Buffett's shareholders asked him what he thought about artificial intelligence. Buffett said that AI could be enormously disruptive and yet beneficial by making the economy more efficient. He said AI would result in significantly less employment in certain areas and require enormous transformation in how people relate to each other, what they expect of government, all kinds of things. Buffett may have based his statements on a PricewaterhouseCoopers study that found nearly 40% of existing jobs could be automated using current technology by the year 2030. So until then, this is Library Anne with Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law with today's Stack Quote.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Melanie Reed, my friend and colleague at the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University, who told us all about RoboCop and the Fourth Amendment. Thanks also to Anne Walsh Long, also known as Library Anne. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, and we'll be back.